We'll proceed to the second case of the day, number 12-1281, United States versus Tucker. Mr. Tronis.
May it please the court. My name is Damon Tronis, and along with Ian Barney, we represent the appellant, Mr. Ivy Tucker, in these proceedings. Neither Mr. Barney nor myself were the lawyers at the district court level. Mr. Tucker was convicted of conspiracy to possess with the intent to distribute in excess of a kilogram of heroin after a three-day jury trial. It's our position that throughout the course of the trial, there were several errors that have to be looked at under the plain error standard in this case because they were not raised that warrant a new trial. Initially, in closing argument, the prosecutor commented regarding what amounted to prior consistent statements that were not introduced into evidence, and those comments so infected the trial with unfairness as to be a denial of due process. It is a fundamental rule of law that a prosecutor or a party, in this case the prosecutor, may not make arguments as to facts outside of the record, and to do so may constitute gross misconduct and plain error. In the government's response, it seems that we disagree regarding one of those comments, at least a comment regarding Charles Stuck's testimony, but it seems that the government concedes that there were some comments that were not based on evidence in the record, but when looked at in the full context of the record, essentially are harmless. It's our position that what the prosecutor did in this case essentially was said to the jury, look at the testimony not only of what occurred in court, but also from the moment they were arrested, when there's no time to get their story straight, right out of the gate, these individuals all said that Ivy Tucker was the individual who was supplying them with heroin. Those statements as such were not in the record. And what the government did essentially was went outside of the record to bolster a case that in our position needed bolstering, because like most federal cases that I'm accustomed to, and I'm sure that this court is accustomed to, you have recordings, you have seizures, you have photographs, you have surveillance, you have many of the trappings that the federal government puts into play in criminal prosecutions. In this case, I think it was unique because there was none of that other than the testimony of the informant witnesses, the cooperating witnesses, all of whom were testifying in exchange for deals or hopes of leniency.
All of that was brought to the attention of the jurors, we assume.
The fact that they were testifying in hopes of leniency?
Yes.
Absolutely it was. It was brought to the attention of the jury. However, what was not brought to the attention of the jury during the course of the trial was that from the moment this individual was arrested, right away, he said X, Y, and Z. And it's our position that when you say that, you go outside the record.
I understand your position.
Okay. Thank you. So by doing that, it would constitute plain error and infected the trial, and I think that's a good word, infected the trial with unfairness.
So what was defense counsel doing? This is such a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Judge, I can say to you that I've pondered that question since I've been on this case, and I'm not sure. I don't know why an objection was not lodged.
If I understand your position correctly, you believe that when those words came out of the prosecutor's mouth, either the first or the second or the third time, the district judge had a duty to declare a mistrial sua sponte, right?
I think that...
plain error, nothing could fix it.
I don't think that. I think once that cat is out of the bag, essentially on four occasions, I don't think anything could happen. Do I think if an objection was raised, potentially a mistrial could have been granted? Absolutely.
What if the response from the district judge, let's just hypothesize an objection having been made, and the judge doesn't sustain it, but says, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'll remind you that what the lawyers say is not evidence, and there's a difference between what the lawyers say and what you remember is the evidence, your memory should control. Is that a sufficient response?
I don't think so, and I think that in the Ferns case, which was the main case we cited regarding this proposition, the court said there was no action that the court could have taken to ameliorate the harm in this case.
I understand and, that, but let me go ahead.
And I think to go further down the road on that, it's almost as if the prosecutor was making a statement outside of the record, but implying that it actually came into evidence. It was one of those weird statements. Having tried cases, I can, if somebody says something that clearly is out of bounds, there's an objection, and I've had that objection sustained. That's not the evidence. Move on. But here, the government, through Officer Baranek, was sort of painting the fences, painting the edges, excuse me, to use a baseball term. We interviewed these people, painting the corners. We interviewed these people. They gave statements. We didn't get into the heart of the statement. We didn't get into them identifying Ivy Tucker, but in closing arguments, we're going to tell you that.
Okay. Here's my concern.
Yes.
If your reading of Ferns is right, then a district judge listening to closing argument by a prosecutor has got to have, in essence, a kind of hair trigger on the mistrial button, okay? Every sentence has to be processed, whether there's an objection or not, for is that reasonably consistent with my memory of the evidence or not? And if I make a mistake, we're going to wind up with a reversal or a mistrial, and we're going to have to start this whole thing over again. Why isn't it reasonable to rely on the first, is that a reasonable burden to impose on the district judge? And second, why not give at least a little more leeway for the adversary process?
Well, I think initially the burden is on the defense counsel, obviously, to lodge proper objections during a criminal trial. When that doesn't happen and a judge does not step in, you're left with the plain error analysis. Now, and it may not be fair to the court, but it certainly isn't fair to Mr. Tucker that a statement like that, and it wasn't one time. I think it was four times. And in rebuttal, it was even driven home, I think, more thoroughly. Shortly after their arrest, they say, this is what happened. All of them. Mr. Tucker. It's just a coincidence. So I understand the court's issue. Certainly the defense attorney should have lodged an objection. But if not, you're still left with a statement outside of the record. And the result of that is that he was denied a fair trial. So I understand that when you think of practically how it can be applied, the real issue is whether or not Mr. Tucker suffered the prejudice, and I think it's clear he did for the reasons I've stated.
Is it a fair or reasonable inference that the reason defense counsel didn't object because the fact that his theory of defense argued in his closing argument was that's all they have? And, in fact, they've done nothing since day one when they got those initial post-arrest statements to today. Their case has gotten no better. Notwithstanding that Officer Baranek said you can't trust these people and you've got to do more and you've got to build a case, they didn't do it. Their case is no better today than it was on day one. That was the defense theory. And if that's your theory, it might well be reasonable for you not to object when the prosecution points out that that's what they said on day one, even if it didn't come into evidence.
I think, and I understand that throughout the closing argument, he made a statement somewhat to the effect, defense counsel, that this was similar to what they said in their debriefs. That's all it is. That was said after the initial three, I think, improper comments were made. And it certainly isn't something that I would do. It certainly isn't something that I would draw attention to. And I think the temporal aspect is also important. In other words, everybody knows that at some point these witnesses probably sat down with the prosecution and was prepped and testified consistently with what they were prepped for.
Is that part of the record?
Excuse me?
Is that part of the record?
Which part, Your Honor?
What you just said. That they sat down and discussed it with them?
No, I'm not sure. I may have
been. You're doing what the prosecutor did in the first case.
Yes, I am. And I don't have any prosecutorial bones in my body, so I will take that away. I think that to answer the court's question, I think that
reasonable inferences.
Reasonable inferences. But I think the reasonable inference can't be, back to my answer to Judge Sharp, I apologize. As far as the temporal aspect is concerned, it went beyond just being debriefed.
How many co-defendants testified that your client was the guilty party?
There were nine essentially cooperating witnesses who testified.
Cooperating witnesses, you mean co-defendants?
Co-defendants, yes, who were cooperating with the government. There were nine. And
I footnoted a portion of why I think the evidence was unremarkable, and I cited the Weisinger case. There was nothing else tying Mr. Tucker to this conspiracy, and I don't think just because it's nine witnesses that necessarily makes the case rock solid, especially if you look
at... It kind of helps a lot.
I'll take nine witnesses without a recording any day, Your Honor. There were no recordings in this case and nothing else. And the witness testimony, and I pointed this out, I couldn't include everything, but the nature of the witness's testimony was extremely leading, and there was very little foundation that was given to a lot of the conversations that allegedly took place. So it's our position, based on those comments, the case should be reversed. Moving to what I think the next issue is.
I'm sorry. Before you move on, I just want to explore the issue of prejudice a little more.
Certainly.
I'll give you those comments, particularly in the initial closing argument, were inappropriate, objectionable. But the question on the plain error review is, you know, did it so completely infect the trial he couldn't have gotten a fair trial? And if defense counsel's theory and what defense counsel affirmatively argued to the jury was really incorporated that error, then, I mean, how at this point can we say that it was fundamentally unfair when it was really consistent with the defense theory?
I don't know if that was necessary. I mean, I know their theory was there was no corroboration. I understand that, that this was just information that was basically being provided by the confidential informants and the cooperating witnesses. I do not know that that was the sole theory, and I do not know if the defense attorney would have made the comment in closing argument regarding statements being made if the prosecutor wouldn't have said it three times in his opening argument.
Fair enough. How do we know that?
I don't know how you know that. I do know that it wasn't invited because it was given by the prosecutor initially. Maybe the defense attorney, for all I know, was caught sort of with nothing else to say regarding it and made that statement. But I think at the end of the day, you still have what amounts to some pretty serious improper conducts being made by the government, in this case outside the record. The next issue, if I could, would be the issue regarding judicial vouching or improperly vouching for the credibility of witnesses. And a prosecutor may not bolster the credibility of a witness by implying that facts not before the jury lend to the witness's credibility. In this case, in plain English, the prosecutor in his closing argument said their deal isn't made with the government. Their deal and their ultimate sentence will be decided by this court. Now, I've sat down in trials and I've heard prosecutors get up and say, Judge Stark is the one who's going to decide the ultimate sentence in this case. And that's a fair argument. But it is not a fair argument to tell a jury, individuals who aren't lawyers, individuals who aren't versed with 5K1s and motions to dismiss and things like that, that the deal is actually with the court. Because what that does is it essentially puts the court as a party to an agreement with a cooperating witness when that's not the case. And this was echoed more than one time. There was no objection. And the prosecutor went further by saying, and Judge Randa, and I'm paraphrasing, is sitting here and he's watching these witnesses and he's weighing what they say. When you take all of those statements together, in the response, the government said it was inartful. I agree it was inartful, but it went on beyond that. It went into the realm of impropriety by making that misstatement. And in a case where the credibility of the witnesses was paramount, I think the plain error may be even more clear, because when you're dealing without recordings and without videos and all those other things, you have a prosecutor saying essentially these witnesses are credible, at least to an extent, because their deal isn't with us. It's with the court. We're distancing ourselves from the deal and we're putting in the court instead of us. I believe I have. I'm going to save my time for rebuttal. If that's.
Let me ask you one question, just on the issue of Officer Baranek's expert testimony. Does the record reflect whether there was any request by the defense for disclosure of expert testimony?
The record does not reflect that.
In other words, there is no evidence in the record that the defense ever requested.
There is nothing in the record that shows that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We'll hear from the government. Mr. Koenig.
May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Koenig, and I appear on behalf of the United States. which successfully prosecuted Mr. Tucker for conspiring to distribute heroin. Good morning to you all. We are asking that you affirm Mr. Tucker's convictions because he had a fair trial. That's the bottom line, whether this is viewed through the prism of the prosecutorial misconduct cases or the plain error standard of review. And I'd like to begin, before I get started, I would like to note a typographical error in our brief on page 10. At the very top, there's a reference to the purity of cocaine. That should be the purity of heroin. Obviously, this is a heroin case. But now I'd like to get right to the what I regard as perhaps the weightiest concern raised by my opponent, which is the alleged references to matters not in the record.
Alleged references?
Well, I would argue with respect to Mr. Stuck that the references were correct, but as noted, I have conceded that the remaining witnesses, did not come out in the trial testimony, so they should not have been referenced. But I would like to echo some of the ideas that were behind Judge Tharp's questions in connection with prejudice. Not only was there not an objection, but the defense attorney did not stand up in his closing and say, ladies and gentlemen, none of that was in evidence. Now, he could have done that. Instead, he chose to acknowledge the witnesses had debriefed consistently with their testimony and move on to what was really his argument in the case. He wanted to talk about debriefings because his argument is that's all the government has.
From whence came the argument that the cooperating witnesses had to deal with the court?
Well, Your Honor, again, I think if you read the quote in its entirety...
I did.
I think what comes across is Judge Randa is going to decide the sentences that are imposed in these cases.
Does that sound like I made a deal with the court?
Well, no, it wasn't. As I conceded in my brief, it was not artfully phrased. But I think the meaning came across.
It was foolishly phrased. The real question is whether it affected the court, the trial, so poor badly we have to reverse. But to... I assume the government's willing to concede that's a lovely thing that they should have stayed away from.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. But that actually brings us to the ultimate question in the case, which is the fairness of the trial. And in connection with the statements we were talking about earlier, the jury was instructed that the lawyer's comments were not evidence. That's a standard instruction, and it was given in this case.
How can we affirm this conviction without overruling Ferns on plain error with precisely the same error having been made?
I would say by relying on McClinton, Your Honor, which is a more recent case that instructs the court to look at the entire context of the trial. I would say here, we do have, it is a historical conspiracy case. I'm not going to say to you that it was overwhelming evidence, but it was a very strong case.
I was looking in your brief for some response to Ferns, and I didn't see it.
Well, Your Honor, I guess the difficulty I have is reconciling McClinton and Ferns, because McClinton seems to say that the plain error analysis does kick in, and you have to look at the entire context. Ferns kind of jumps right to the impropriety and resolves it on that basis.
Well, this is the kind of discussion that I tend to look for in briefs, if you're asking us to overrule or if you think there's a serious tension within our case law.
I don't think that Ferns was wrong, Your Honor, in calling attention to the impropriety of the remarks.
Okay.
But we are dealing with plain error, and so I think...
So was Ferns, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And without much analysis, you had, judges of this court saying, in essence, this is so obvious, this was gross misconduct, and nothing could have fixed this, we've got to reverse this, right?
Yes.
So what do we do with Ferns?
I think the court should take an opportunity to reaffirm what's in McClinton, which is that you look at the entire context of the trial to determine its fairness, and that would include the weight of the evidence. And again, I'm not going to try to tell you this was an overwhelming evidence case. It wasn't, but it was a very strong case. There were 9 witnesses against the defendant. And the jury was properly instructed, and many of the statements that are complained of here played into the defense strategy, trial strategy. And when you look at the entire context of the trial, it was fair. We would ask you to affirm. Have I answered your question or no?
What do we say about Ferns?
Your Honor, I don't think this is a situation where you have to overrule Ferns. I think you can just, it's a matter of emphasis, really. You can say whatever you choose to say about the propriety of the remarks.
Well, I think we all agree on that. I think even you agree on that.
Yes, sir.
So, then we get to the plain error problem, where Ferns tells us, even though defendants did not object when the prosecutor went outside the record in his opening argument, and their objection was sustained when he did so in rebuttal, the prosecutor's gross misconduct requires reversal under the plain error rule. The prejudice could not have been eradicated by any action of the trial judge. The prosecutor deliberately violated the fundamental rule known to every lawyer that argument is limited to the facts and evidence. Reversed.
Mm-hmm.
For a new trial.
Well, to the extent Ferns ignores the plain error test, the it should be overruled, I suppose. I think McClinton is a more complete and better reasoned decision. But again, I'm not taking issue with what Ferns says about the propriety of the comments or the impropriety of the comments.
If the defense lawyer had not made the argument that he made in closing, and had instead done what you suggested he could have done, simply pointed out the problem, or if he had objected, do you still maintain that there would, in that case, be no plain error? Or no prejudice arising from, obviously, if he had objected, there wouldn't be plain error, but that he still would have had a fair trial, that the objection or his statement that wasn't, his simple statement that wasn't evidence in the record would be sufficient to cure the prejudice from the prosecutor's invocation of evidence that was not presented at trial?
Well, I think either way we would survive the plain error test because in your hypothetical, it's all laid out for the jury. In what actually happened, it's turned to the advantage of the defendant to the extent that it's utilized as part of the defense. So the real question here in this case is, was there an opportunity to do something about it? And there was. It seems to have been foregone as a matter of trial strategy. Lastly, on the dual testimony issue, again, I'm obviously aware of this court's decisions in York and Christian and several other cases, including one, I think, yesterday from this court, that that outline the way this testimony is supposed to be handled. And so I don't want to run away from that either, but I would make 2 points here. One is that, I guess, on the spectrum of expert testimony, this testimony wasn't very expert-y. I mean, he wasn't opining about, we didn't have a beat cop opining about the chemical composition of cocaine, for example, or something really far afield from his experiences and his work experience as laid out for the jury.
Do you agree that if an objection had been raised, it would have produced the spectacle of the judge telling the ladies and gentlemen of the jury, this man is an expert?
Mm-hmm. That's probably what would have happened, and that brings me to my next point, which is there's no argument in this appeal that Officer Baranek, who had 9 years of experience doing drug cases, would not have qualified as an expert. And I think that is fatal to his argument under the plain error standard of review. So, again, unless the panel has further questions, we would ask that you affirm.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Koenig. Rebuttal, Mr. Chironis.
Thank you. I believe the best comparison to Ferns is that there are more statements in this case that were improper than there were in Ferns. The prosecutor made four comments as opposed to the two in Ferns. And I think one of the interesting things in Ferns is that there was an objection, actually, to one of the comments. The first comment, there was no objection. The second one, there was. But even in the face of that, the court held it to be reversible error. And I think that it goes to the Ferns decision had a great quote. It was either Ferns or Davis, which relied on Ferns, and that said that litigants are entitled to a fair day in court. They're entitled to fairness. You're never going to get a perfect trial. I've yet to see one, and I don't think I ever will. But a fair trial. And in this case, the prosecutor, I think, undermined that by making several comments, maybe the worst of which were the ones that were outside of the record, but he did that four times. And then he also made the comment that Judge Bauer asked about regarding whether or not a deal was made with the judge. That's what he said. And when you look at the cumulative error doctrine, there's certainly more than one error in this case. And the prosecutor has seemed to concede that the evidence was not overwhelming. It wasn't. And we are asking that you allow Mr. Tucker to have another trial and hopefully a fair one. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chironis. The case is taken under advisement.